Hi everyone, I am your host Siglali and welcome to Do Not Cross. Do Not Cross is a true crime podcast where we talk about cases from the 1800s to present day. And this is your ordinary podcast. We talk about cases, about lesser known cases, because you probably get tired of hearing the really known cases. So today we talk about lesser known cases, and this is our first episode. And since this is our first episode, I decided to start it off with the banger today. It's not a big case, but it's a lesser known serial killer that many people have not heard about. Before we continue, I would like to add a little disclaimer. Disclaimer, what you're about to listen contains explicit content, violence, adult dialogue, and sexual assault. It may not be suitable for viewers under 18. Viewer discretion is advised. Okay, so today we're going to be talking about the Genesee River Killer, also known as Arthur Shawcross, I don't know, it's any one of those. And he was born on the 6th of June in 1945 in Kittery, Maine. He was born 1 month premature and had to stay in the hospital an extra 20 days. His parents were Elizabeth Yerkes? I don't know, dude. And she was 18 at the time. And his dad, Arthur Shawcross, was 21 when the baby Arthur was born. And he had three siblings, sister Donna, which she was younger than Arthur by a year. And Jean was 3 years younger than Arthur, and Arthur also had a brother named Jimmy. At age four, he claimed that his dad would beat him with a bell and a broom handle, but none of this was confirmed. And ages 6 to 8, he began running away from school and started talking to his imaginary friends. He started bullying younger kids at school, and he still ran away because he felt that his parents loved his siblings more than him. At age 9, he claimed his aunt sexually molested him when he was 9, and he had sexual relationship with his younger sister. He also admitted to his first homosexual encounter at the age of 11, which he says was followed by an experimentation with bestiality, which is kind of gross, dude. Also, he got hit in the head with a stone, which caused him to go to the hospital and get stitches. And from ages 10 to 13, he started shoplifting and began to explore masturbation. I don't know why he whispered that. I'm just being weird. And whenever his mom would catch him, she would threaten him with a butcher knife, and she would stuck a broomstick up his rectum. Which, none of this is confirmed, has not been confirmed. But, and at 13, his family built a house in Brownsville, New York. From ages 14 and 19, he claimed to have sex with his neighbor, which was a girl. And whenever her brother, the neighbor's brother, would catch him, he would force Arthur to perform oral sex on him. He starts getting more engaged with bestiality. He started failing school grades, which caused him to get held back a couple times. And he started to become more violent and would even be known to set bushes on fire. And he dropped out of school at 17 years old. He was a freshman. The reason why I tell you all this is kind of give you like a background information on what led him to become mentally ill to kill people. And trying to give you guys the also, he had a bad background, but I'm not on his side, dude. I've never been on his side. But I'm letting you guys know that this could be causes of what caused him, you know, to start killing people. And also, head injuries have been assigned to many serial killers. They were fine, but once they had a head injury, that's kind of what changed them. First wife was Sarah Chatterton, and they met while they were working at a family bargain center, which he ended up getting fired from because he was known to be really rude at his co-workers and customers. They ended up getting married in September of 1964, and they had their first son, who they named Michael. And Michael was born in October of the following year, but Sarah ended up divorcing Arthur because of his attitude. He started being really mean towards her, and she was like, I gotta dip. Like, I'm not gonna do this, dude. Arthur ended up getting drafted into the military when he was 19 in April 1966. He fell off a 40-foot ladder and hit his head, which also, it's another brain injury, so it could have caused him, you know, to go crazy. Just saying. And in October 1967, Arthur was sent to the Vietnam War as a supply specialist. He fought in the Vietnam War, where he later confessed that he had murdered and cannibalized two young Vietnamese girls. Although there is nothing to back up his claim on his return from the military duty in 1968, he landed in trouble yet again when he was caught and convicted for an arson attack. Shakras served 2 years of a 5-year jail term. Like I said earlier, there's nothing to back up that he murdered or cannibalized two young girls. Well, even his sergeants and his generals, they even said that he's never killed a single person. And during the military, he would brag about how he killed over 40 something people. And it was later confirmed by his generals and people in the military that he has not killed a single person. So now we're starting to get into the serial killings. A year later, after he came back from the Vietnam War on April 17, 1972, he claimed his first victim, which was a 10-year-old neighbor, Jack Blake. Shakras took him fishing just a few days before he disappeared, but denied any knowledge of the disappearance. Several weeks later, on April 22, 1972, so like 4 days after, he married his third wife. Arthur married his third wife, Penny Cherubino, who was pregnant with his child. 5 months later, the boy's body was finally found. He had been sexually assaulted and suffocated, but police had no leads to identify the killer. And Jack Blake, the 10-year-old victim, would be the first of many victims to come. Later in September 1972, the body of eight-year-old Karen Ann Hill was found under a bridge. She had been raped and murdered. Police found mud leaves and other debris had been forced down her throat and inside her clothing. Neighbors remember that Shakras had been seen with Karen in the vicinity of the bridge before her disappearance. He had a history of minor run-ins with local children, but Shakras came under. But as soon as they realized that he had a history, he was immediately put under suspicion. He was later arrested on October 3rd, 1972, and finally confessed to both killings. Although he was only charged with Karen Hill's killing, given the lack of evidence tying him to Jack Blake's death, he received a 25-year jail sentence, and the third wife, Penny, divorced him shortly thereafter because she was not about to be committed to a serial killer because she knew. Like, he was kind of up. She knew that he was not a good person. So she was like, I'm not ready for this type of commitment. So from now on, you're on your own, basically. I mean, I don't bang her, dude. I would have left him too, or anybody, if I found out there was a serial killer. After serving less than 15 years of his sentence, he was released on parole in April 1987. The well-publicized resettlement of a child killer in the Binghamton area of New York State was greeted by a public outcry, and he was forced to leave the area after a few months along with his new girlfriend, Rose Riley. He doesn't deserve to be alive, and also he doesn't deserve to have a new girlfriend. Okay. But anyway, going back to the story. Why does he have a new girlfriend, dude? Like, I don't know if his girlfriend, like, already knew, like, what was up with him. But I'm pretty sure she knew. I don't know why anyone would want him. My name is, like I said, going back to the story. His past meant that he would be unwelcome almost anywhere. And the authorities made the decision to seal his criminal record in order to prevent a reoccurrence of public alarm in Binghamton. It did not take long for Shacross to return to his murderous ways. Hunters discovered his next victim, which was a 27-year-old prostitute, Dorothy Blackburn. On March 24, 1988, her body was found in the Genesee River, and it was dumped there following a vicious attack, which included bite marks in her groin area and signs of strangulation. With little evidence and no public encounters or anybody seeing anybody, it was impossible to solve the murder. Her case languished for over a year. They discovered the body of another prostitute, Anna Stephan, on September 9, 1989, linked several of the victims. She died of asphyxiation, and her body had been dumped in a similar manner to Blackburn's corpse. The body was placed further so it wouldn't raise any suspicion. So in his mind, he was like, hey, like, maybe if I place him in different spots, they won't think that it's the same person, you know? He's gonna end up getting caught. I'm sorry for spoiling it, but I'm just saying. As prostitutes continued to disappear, it became apparent that the killer must be someone familiar to the woman who worked in the area. Policemen ended up, like, you know, going around where prostitutes were common, and they ended up asking, like, hey, like, do you know if there's, like, a regular customer somewhere, and he's taking women, but they never come back. And many people said that there's a regular client that he called himself Mitch or either Mike. After finding 11 unsolved prostitute murders, they ended up dividing them based on the method and position they were found in. And they developed a file that described the killer as a white male, either in his 20s, between his 20s or 30s, who was strong, probably with a previous criminal record and was familiar with the area, and was obviously comfortable enough with the victims that the victims would enter his vehicle, like, voluntarily, like, without a question. And on January 2nd, 1990, a helicopter spotted what appeared to be a naked female body lying on the ice surface of a river by a bridge in a forest. The body was not Felicia Stevens, but that of a missing prostitute, June Cicero. She had also been mutilated post-mortem, as well as sawn practically in half. Even more importantly, the helicopter spotted a man standing on the bridge next to the small van. He either appeared to be peeing or masturbating. Fortunately for the authorities, Shacross had, as speculated, returned to the scene of his crimes to relive the pleasure of attack. And patrol teams on the ground were alerted to the vehicle, which had sped away. They finally tracked down Shacross via the car registration, which was in the name of his girlfriend, Clara Neal. You know, now he has a different girlfriend, dude. When he approached, Shacross agreed to assist the police with their questioning, and he was like, you know what? Like, I don't mind. Like, you guys got nothing on me. And when they asked for his driver's license, he admitted that he did not have one, and they revealed that he had been in jail for manslaughter. I feel like Arthur capitulated and admitted to most of the murders, giving detailed excuses about why he had been, in quote, forced, in quote, to kill each one. He even admitted to killing of two undiscovered bodies, those of prostitutes Maria Welsh and Darlene Trippi. Leading investigators to the bodies, his formal confession was nearly 80 pages long. Later on November 1990, Shacross went on trial for the 10 murders that occurred in Monroe County. The last victim, Elizabeth Gibson, had been killed in the neighboring Wayne County. The trial was a national media event, extensively televised and widely viewed. Shacross's defense team tried to build a case based on an insanity plea, saying that
that he was not in the right mind when he was killing. They ended up bringing up his PTSD from the military. And they brought up that he had a cyst on the brain. And had a cyst on his brain. And he had a rare genetic defect. Shakaz was declared sane. Because I'm pretty sure he knew what he was doing. He just didn't want to get a big sentence. And Arthur was guilty of 10 instances of second-degree murder. I'm so sorry. The judge sentenced him to 25 years for each count. So 25 years for each murder, which would add up to a total of 250 years of imprisonment. And Shakaz was held at the Sullivan Correctional Facility in New York State until November 10, 2008, when he complained of a pain in his leg. He was transferred to a hospital where he had died later that day of cardiac arrest.
As we learn, Arthur Shakaz, also known as the Genesee River Killer, is a pretty, pretty shitty person. And he deserved, I don't want to say this, but he kind of deserved the death penalty. I don't want to say it, because I know I don't want to get, like, you know, hate for it. But it's true. Like, I don't really like the death penalty. I'm not really in favor of it. But, for example, if it's someone who killed and murdered and brutally murdered a bunch of people, including little kids, saying they deserve way worse than jail. They deserve pain, like how those victims felt pain. I don't know, but that's just my opinion, to be honest. He deserved way worse than 250 years. Well, I'm not saying that 250 years isn't bad. I'm just saying he doesn't deserve to be alive when he killed 10 or 11 innocent people. I gave the biography kind of like what caused him to become a serial killer. And I'm not saying it's an excuse for him. There's no excuse for becoming a serial killer. But I don't know why he tried bringing that up in court when he was getting trialed, when he was like, oh yeah, and I can have a genetic defect and I have PTSD. How do I say this without getting let me try to word it real quick. Anyways, he was a piece of shit. He deserved death or literal pain, like how his victims felt pain. And I know that nothing's gonna bring the victims back, but he's already dead, but he deserved to feel the pain that he caused other people to feel pain, not only them, but their families, you know? But yes, this was a pretty heavy story. I kind of wanted to start off the show with a bang, you know? This game was a pretty big bang. And I hope you guys liked the episode. I hope you guys tune in for my second episode, which is going to air on Tuesday. Tuesday. And keep tuning in. I'll see you guys next time.